Hey Ramesh, how are you?
Just great. Yourself?
Pretty good.
Good.
So I guess we should start by introducing ourselves. My name's Michelle Goldberg. I'm a columnist for the Daily Beast. I freelance for a bunch of other places, and most of my time is spent on my books, the most recent one of which is The Means of Reproduction.
And I'm Ramesh Panuru. I'm a senior editor at National Review, and I freelance for Time Magazine, among other places.
So we were going to start off today by talking about the uproar over the Islamic Center that's being built by Ground Zero. And I mean, it actually sort of surprises me the extent to which the opposition to it is, I guess, the blatancy of the opposition to it and the kind of the temperature of it. I mean, one of the things, I never thought I would be saying this, but one of the things I suppose that George Bush deserves credit for in retrospect is that he never really took the, or he didn't. I think he studiously avoided demonizing Islam and demonizing American Muslims. And what happened to that restraint?
Right. Well, that's an interesting question. I think I should just as a bottom line answer on this, I do think that it's pretty basic First Amendment doctrine here that there's nothing that the government can do or should do about this. I think that there's been, even at the time, there were many conservatives who disliked how all-encompassing Bush's rhetoric about Islam was. The Islam is a religion of peace, which isn't really sort of within, let's say, the previous president or the current president's competence to judge. And so I think there was always this undercurrent of conservative skepticism about the kind of the philo-Islamery of the previous president, if we could call it that. And without Bush in the office of the White House, that has now come out into the open.
And is there any, I mean, given that, again, like you said, this is a pretty basic First Amendment question, and I've got to think that there are people on the right who imagine that setting a precedent that, you know, kind of a community that you can't open a religious center if the community or if the surrounding city disagrees with either imagined or real parts of its religious doctrine. I mean, where are the kind of religious freedom people on this? I mean, you know,
Well,
like
yeah,
the
that's a
First Amendment.
really. After this is done, I think I'll call the Beckett Center for Religious Freedom, which is a conservative group that has done a lot of work on that sort of thing, and see what their view of the matter is. But let me also just say that some of the criticism of the mosque
Which
isn't
is not a
suggest.
mosque. We should
Oh, I'm sorry. The cultural center. Excuse me. Is it's just the shorthand. Everybody's calling it the Ground Zero Mosque.
Right, which I have too, so.
Right. The some of the criticism isn't calling for government action. It's more calling for, well, this is insensitive. This isn't tactful. Let's not do this. And for all of the sort of grammatical and linguistic problems in Governor Palin's Twitters or tweets or whatever you call those things, that it seems to me is actually a relatively healthy expression of this opposition because that's what she's saying. It's like let's, as she puts it, repudiate
Repudiate.
this as opposed to let's have the zoning authorities or the state governments or something stop this.
But isn't that sort of in bad faith? Because it strikes me as being, I don't know, a little bit preposterous to think that, you know, mainstream Muslims or, you know, what she calls peace-loving Muslims are supposed to say to themselves, oh, yes, obviously, people have a right to think that our religion did precipitate the attacks on the World Trade Center, and we should really, you know, kind of honor their sensitivities by what? By hiding? By kind of keep by sit by staying? What's the radius? I mean, how far out of the financial district do they have? You know, should peace-loving Muslims, out of kind of respect for the mores of the heartland, keep themselves? Yeah, I mean, the other thing that kind of maddens me about this is just the so-called heartland double standard regarding New York City. You know, I mean, 99% of the time we're Sodom on the Hudson, and, you know, we're kind of this hotbed of out of touch elites and, you know, kind of depraved, you know, decadent, pointy-headed intellectuals. And then every so often we become the capital of America and the rest of the country feels like it has some kind of claim on mm-hmm. on New York City. I mean, the majority of the residents of Manhattan have no problem with this mosque, although there's obviously a sizable minority that does. So the idea that we're supposed to kind of avoid, as I think Sarah Palin put it, stabbing, that this is a stab in the heart to the heartland, I mean, that just strikes me as insane.
That's an interesting point. I do think that a lot of this sort of, it sort of reminds me of some of the stuff I've read from Thomas Frank, just because we both happen to have gone to the same high school in Kansas City, about the resentment toward Northeastern, you know, cosmopolitan elites that are supposedly bred among Kansans. And I just don't think that a lot of that's really true. You know, I mean, I don't think actually people in the so-called heartland actually do, seethe with resentment towards New York, et cetera. It's the sort of thing that that it just seems like it's dated rhetoric.
But really, you don't feel like you ever hear rhetoric on the right lambasting coastal elites or lambasting...
Oh, no, my point isn't that the rhetoric doesn't exist. My point is that I don't know whether it's actually what binds grassroots conservatives to the right. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think it's like, you know, when you hear, you know, Tim Pawlenty a couple months ago was complaining about pre-eating elites, and it just seemed like, you know, it was 15, 20 years out of date. What? I'm sorry, what?
I mean, that's like the, I guess that was what people complained about in the 80s.
Well, right, exactly. Everybody gets free now, so, yes. But it seems like, you know, in a certain way, we don't really disagree about this, so maybe we should move on to...
Okay, and to something that we do disagree on.
Right, well, who knows whether we actually will. I've been enjoying the sort of Democrat on Democrat infighting over the last week. Much of it started by White House spokesman Robert Gibbs when he suggested that the control of the House was in play. What do you think about the ensuing spectacle?
I'm not sure how much this is infighting, this is infighting over kind of fairly obscure questions of political strategy, right? Not over questions of larger principle. I mean, at least about kind of, you know, whether we're going to acknowledge the reality of the fact that we're facing potentially a pretty brutal midterm election. I mean, to me, this is kind of more of a Politico story than a real story.
Right.
You know, this is one of those stories that kind of is going to occupy, you know, some kind of panels on CNN and a few blogs and stuff, but it doesn't really matter. I mean, to me, the bigger question and where the bigger disagreements are is the fact that whether or not the House is in play, things look fairly grim for the Democrats. I think that there's a real divide as to kind of why and what to do about it. I think that the consensus among liberals, and the consensus that I think is correct, is that we're facing a drubbing because the economy is terrible, and that one reason the economy is terrible is because we badly need a bigger stimulus, and that, you know, kind of mainstream, but there's a certain part of the Democratic Party that kind of bowing to short-term political realities instead of, you know, kind of economic expertise is saying that a bigger stimulus is impossible, and so we have to make these kind of gestures towards budget cutting, which is ultimately likely to, or not budget cutting, gestures towards budget balancing, which is ultimately likely to make things a lot worse.
Right, and Senator, he is now the Vice President. Vice President Joe Biden over the weekend suggested that the White House had shrunk the stimulus in order to attract the support of Republicans.
Well, do you think there's any doubt about that? I mean, to me, that's fairly, you know, that's kind of like the sky is blue. Of course that's what they did.
Right, although, you know, the thing is, well, I guess two things. One, they did originally come out with a $775 billion stimulus. It's not as though it got shrunk after that point. And second, if that's their concern, they should have gone with a higher number to begin with, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's, you know, I mean, that's just their own mistake. I don't think that, well, look, to get back to the Gibbs point, I don't think that the debate is solely about, you know, should there be public acknowledgement that it's going to be a bad election. There's also some simmering resentments over the idea that the White House just hasn't done enough for the House, that Obama is more concerned about preserving his own brand than about helping them. And especially there is anger at Senate Democrats for not having moved on a number of things that the House Democrats moved on. And there again, you got to wonder, you know, what were the House Democrats thinking? Did they really think that having barely squeaked through a cap and trade vote in the House, that the Senate, where the geography was going to be worse, was going to just pass this really easily? You know, I mean, they should have realized that there was every chance that they would be out there on a limb with no enactment of cap and trade. I mean, I think that was pretty obvious even at the time that the House was making that vote.
Well, and, you know, I'm very, very, very much in favor of a cap and trade bill. Obviously, I'm not sure how that really plays into the midterm elections. I mean, I can't really think that very many people feel like their House seats are in danger because cap and trade didn't pass.
I think there are definitely some districts. I mean, if you look at like Ben Chandler in Kentucky, for example, I think it was a risky vote to cast. Probably not, more than 20 or so House Democrats, but that's a pretty large number.
But
on the other hand, they wouldn't have necessarily been better off if it had actually been enacted either.
Well, I guess that's what I'm saying. I mean, I guess you'd be angry that you've gone out on a limb and you didn't even actually accomplish something for the greater good, that you kind of just take the political hit without getting any kind of result. But from a political point of view, I can't imagine if voting for cap and trade was really politically damaging, then the failure of cap and trade isn't really going to compound that.
Right. Well, you know, I mean, the economy, you mentioned the economy, obviously that is the dominant problem for the Democrats going in here, although it's not the only one. I mean, partly it's just, you know, even if the economy was okay and there weren't a national skepticism to hostility of things like the health care bill, just the fact that they did so well in 06 and 08, there would be some natural settling back in this election. But when you add to it the economy, and I was just trying to think this through, I think this is maybe the worst economy from the Democrats' political point of view since 1988. I can't think of a political cycle where the economy has been more harmful or more helpful to the Republicans in the last 22 years.
But this then kind of leads into another question, which is, you know, another thing that we were saying we were going to talk about is, do the Republicans run on an actual platform, or do they just run on, you know, kind of Obama's destroying the country? How do the Republicans run, if they are to run on a platform, how do they run simultaneously on the need to balance the budget and wanting to extend upper bracket tax cuts?
Right. Well, if they were going to do that, they would have to, I think, have some actual spending cuts on the table. But as you suggest, there is a real question now as to whether the Republicans want to run on a specific policy agenda at all. A lot of Republicans, you can really tell, I mean, just the mood of Republicans over the last month or so in Washington, D.C., there's much less worry There's much less fear that the Tea Partiers are going to make them have to come up with a specific policy agenda, more complacency that the election's already won, and more of a sense that they just need to oppose Obama. So we now have the situation where you've got a bunch of Republicans with no agenda. You've got the sort of Paul Ryan Republicans who have this hugely ambitious agenda to reform everything, and you don't have anything in between in terms of like a list of 10, you know, semi-achievable ideas. I think that if the Republicans don't run on an actual platform, I think they're making a real mistake. But right now, the no platform folks, I think, have the upper hand.
But I'm surprised to hear you say that, because from my kind of very outside perspective, or, you know, certainly outside kind of the conservative movement, it looks to me like the Republicans are becoming slightly more confident about putting forward agenda items. I mean, certainly, you know, I'm trying to think of what they've been recently, but Boehner obviously is talking about his year-long suspension of regulations. They're starting to talk about raising the retirement age to 70, which actually seems to have a little bit of Democratic support as well. Talking more about means-testing Social Security. It's been a while, it seems to me, since Republicans have talked about Social Security reform. I mean, they spent the past year saying that that the government needs to keep its hands off your Medicare. And so it seems to me like they actually are starting to put forward some of their proposals. Again, expanding the Bush, or at least, you know, extending the Bush tax cuts, et cetera.
Well, look, Steny Hoyer, I think, the number two Democrat in the House, by talking up raising the retirement age and means testing, sort of gave the Republicans permission to echo him. But at the same time, I just have as much as I myself favor those ideas, I have a really hard time seeing Republicans generally running on them in the fall. I just can't imagine Republicans doing anything that sensible.
Well,
or the Democrats letting them get away with it if they did.
Well, this is also, I don't think means testing Social Security is sensible. I think raising the age of retirement, although probably not to 70, might be sensible, but this is kind of a broader problem with our politics, is that there actually is no benefit to making kind of sensible but unpopular cost-cutting suggestions. right?
I think that the commission, the Erskine Bowles, Alan Simpson thing, the early days of the commission have actually gone reasonably well from the point of view of wanting to cut some sort of deal and get some long-term deficit reduction. I mean, I'm not saying that is a more likely than not outcome. I'm just saying the commission's actually gone a little better than I expected. And the fact that you've got Boehner and Hoyer both in their different ways giving a little bit of support to it, things could be going worse.
Wait, so I have a question for you. How much are the Republicans going to run on repealing the health care bill? Because it seems to me that while people might have questions and unease about the health care bill more broadly, most of the provisions of it are pretty popular, and kind of people are going to be pretty angry about having any one of them taken away.
Right. Well, I wouldn't say most of the provisions are pretty popular. I would say that some of them are, and that's the reason for a lot of Republican ambivalence. Some Republicans are very worried about things like the ban on taking account of pre-existing conditions. They don't want repeal that, or at least if they do, they want to have some sort of alternative solution.
Do they really want to repeal that?
The thing is, if you don't repeal that, you have to accept everything else, right? I mean, if you don't repeal that, then you have to have the individual mandate, and you have to have subsidies to help people comply with the mandate. I just don't think there's any way of getting around that. And the mandate is still quite unpopular.
Mm-hmm.
If you view it as a package deal, the popularity is not that substantial. And the question is sort of, you know, does the unpopularity of the mandate outweigh the popularity of the of the ban on pre-existing conditions. And I think so far the polling, you know, the polling on the question of Obamacare as a whole suggests that it does outweigh. And I think that the Republicans are going to campaign on repeal. The real question is going to be, has been really, is it repeal and replace, or do you, how much emphasis do you put on you're going to replace the Obamacare legislation with something else, and how much do you emphasize we're going to get rid of it and, you know, burn the building down and salt the earth?
Well, and I mean, is it that they can campaign on that because they know it's not going to happen, so they know they're actually not responsible for coming up with some kind of theoretical plan that would both take care of the pre-existing conditions part, but also kind of free people from this mandate that they consider onerous? I mean, if they had to come up with a solution, they'd be in a much tougher spot.
Oh, yeah. Well, look, there's no question that Obamacare is not going to be repealed in the next 2 years. You've got President Obama in the White House. And so a lot of what the Republicans need to do, if they're serious about repealing Obamacare, and I'd say about half of them are, is prepare the ground for a 2012 debate. And that would mean things like you hold a test vote on repeal, see what the new numbers in the new Congress, how many, you know, what you've got, and then you probably have a series of budget fights. You probably have things like a bill to repeal the tax on medical devices and pay for it by delaying implementation of Obamacare, or restoring some of the Medicare Advantage money and, again, paying for it by delaying implementation. I think those would actually be really tough votes for the Democrats and very useful ways of setting up the debate for 2012. But beyond that sort of thing, I don't think that that you see a lot of actual policy action in the next Congress.
Are you at all worried about some of the... I mean, obviously, I think you guys have reason to be worried about Nevada, possibly Kentucky. Do you think that there's a possibility that given the kind of either, you know, ideological overreach or just plain kind of lunacy of the Tea Party, that things are actually not going to be as sweet for you in November as everybody seems to be predicting?
Absolutely. I would say, John Chait made this point the other day that, you know, conservatives have reduced their chances of picking up seats in Nevada, Kentucky, Pennsylvania, and Florida because of these things. I think, well, I mean, you could quibble with some of these, some of the details, but I think it's sort of a package deal. You know, you've on the one hand, you get this enthusiasm and sort of this tide of public opinion. On the other hand, you do have primaries that don't go well from the point of view of maximizing your likelihood of picking up the seat. I just think it's a package deal, and as a package, are Republicans better off? I think the answer is probably yes. Nevada's still within reach. I'd still, I think, bet on Rubio winning in Florida and Toomey winning in Pennsylvania. And
really?
Paul winning in Kentucky. I would think of those races, Nevada's the one that that Republicans ought to be most worried about.
I would take that bet on Florida.
Okay, well, you know, Alec, I think that Crist has been artificially up because of the oil spill, and that is going to dissipate. Also, Rubio has sort of gone dark in terms of ads, and there is a, you know, there's just this obvious line of attack on Crist as somebody who doesn't believe in anything and is just a complete opportunist. I think that his numbers are artificially high, and that they're going to sink in the next couple months. But no, we'll see.
Okay. Well, yeah, maybe we can revisit this in November.
In a couple months, yeah. But you know, look, I mean, I'm not saying that Toomey's a done deal either in Pennsylvania, and Rand Paul, it depends on what he has to say. I mean, the funny thing is, what everybody's forgotten about the Kentucky race is that there was a contested Democratic primary too, and the more liberal candidate won. The question is going to be, is Rand Paul going to continue to make this race turn on the more esoteric aspects of his philosophy, or is it going to be about the Democrats in Washington and Jack Conway? If it's about the latter, I think that Rand Paul wins. And I don't think it's even necessarily a tight race.
Really? You don't even think, I mean, you don't think, it, and you know, honestly, I don't know enough about Kentucky to know how mm-hmm. much any of this comes back to haunt him, you know, how much people
right.
in Kentucky care about, you know, either the kind of multifarious evils of the Fed, or whether they, you know, kind of agree with his incredible, you know, with his kind of extreme isolationism.
Well, if this was a different year, he'd be toast, I think. You know, if this were 2012 and he was running, I think Rand Paul and Sharon Angle would not be in contention in statewide races this year. But it's an unusually conservative year, I think. You know, it's an unusually conservative electorate we're going to have this fall, and that's what's going to make things possible for them. And that actually is my real worry about the Tea Partiers and the way the Republicans are moving right now. It's not that they're going to blow some of these races so much as it's that the party is not doing anything.
Sarah Palin in 2012.
Well, it's not. I actually don't even worry about that. I just don't think the party's doing anything to address its long-term problems. I don't think Palin's going to even run. I just don't see her doing almost any of the things that you'd have to do to run. But you know, sort of regardless of who the nominee is, if the mood of the national party is, if the mood of conservatives nationwide is, we don't need to reform anything, and we just need to run on true blue conservatism, and we don't need to have a platform of solutions for the problems that that swing voters have with government policy, then, or economic conditions, then I think that that 2012 is going to be thrown away.
Well, I mean, how at this point is the Republican Party even capable of nominating someone who kind of comes up? I mean, given the kind of influence of the Tea Party on the party, how is the Republican Party capable of nominating somebody who can get, you know, kind of any votes from anybody who's to the right of, I don't know, John Boehner?
You mean to the left of John Boehner?
Yes, exactly.
Right. Well, I mean, that's, you know, I mean, partly the question is going to be, if conservatives are in a mood for just sort of vague rhetoric and they're willing to accept that, then maybe whoever wins in 2012 can get through the primaries without having pinned himself down on a bunch of specific policies and then move into the fall with a more centrist, palatable agenda, but that's a really tough gamble. You know, it's, I think it's highly unlikely that the party is going to, overcome its problems with, particularly with Hispanics, with the college educated voters, with young people, if it doesn't do any work on it before the second half of 2012.
Right. And although it might be a kind of winning proposition in the short term, it's doomed in the long term. I mean, assuming some kind of massive, you know, absence of massive realignment in the country. One thing.
Well, and especially if you have a big win this year that results in even more hubris following mm-hmm. it.
No, I mean, it strikes me that although certainly I don't want Republicans to win in 2010, because, you know, there's a lot of things that I actually want to see done, including cap and trade, et cetera. But it actually strikes me as not being the worst thing in the world for Obama, because he gets to then run against Republican obstruction and kind of shift a lot of the blame onto a perennial unpopular Congress for
yeah.
the continuing problems, instead of basically, because, you know, and some of these problems are simply, and probably I would think conservatives would believe this even more than I do, that some of these problems, you know, especially these broader economic problems, are just beyond the power of the government to fix, and
right.
certainly to fix quickly.
Yeah, that's right. You know, I mean, although, you know, economic conditions elected a lot of Democrats in 2008, so, I mean, some of this is just, that's the way politics works. I would say that the pros for Obama with the Republican takeover of the House are what you suggested. I mean, he gets a foil. He gets to say in 2012, I would have made things a lot better, but John Boehner stopped me. I think it's harder to do, though, if the Senate still remains Democratic. I think that's, you know, that's slightly helpful to Obama, but not terrifically helpful. And then the negative side is you got to deal with all of these committee chairmen who have investigations that they want to run and have subpoena powers.
Well, and the other negative thing is that actually there are things that that Obama wants to do, and there are things that the Democrats want.
Right, no, but I'm just thinking in terms of the political, you know, in terms of 2012 and winning, the political calculation.
Right, so do you really think if they win, if the Republicans win, are we going to really start seeing, like, kind of investigations into the corrupt failure to investigate, you know, the terrible threat posed by the new Black Panther Party? Is that what we're looking at?
Well, yes. Actually, yes, I do think that. I mean, do you think that Daryl Issa wouldn't do that?
What?
You know, I mean, I think that, yes, that would absolutely, there'd be you know, who knows what, you know, there'll be stuff that people just haven't looked into. You know, maybe there'll be more of an investigation about the Sestak and Romanoff job offers. They're just things that we're not even thinking of right now. And that's something that any White House would have to be thinking about and I think probably preparing for. But I think at the end of the day, the question is going to be the economy in 2012. Mm-hmm. You know, one hates to make such an obvious point, but that's
always the question.
Right, yeah, right. I mean, I wouldn't say always, right? I mean, like 2002, 2004, I don't think those were particularly economy-driven elections. I mean, obviously, it was an important issue both years. But I think it's more of one in this election, in the 2012 election. So nobody knows anything, I guess, except maybe next time Blankenship should have some actual economists to do the long-term forecast for 2012, although I'm not sure what they know either. And on that note of epistemological modesty, unless there's another topic you want to address, maybe we should call it a day.
No, we'll wrap it up, and when Charlie Christ, who I can't believe I'm rooting for, wins, you'll owe me a drink.
Excellent.
Okay.
Or vice versa.
All right. Well, thanks a lot.
See ya.
See you later. Bye-bye.